Welcome to The Road to Now, where we look to the past
and everywhere in between
to understand the present. I'm Bob Crawford, and joining me as always is Dr. Ben Sawyer.
Ben, I had quite an interesting week last week.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, my wife and I and some friends took a trip to Savannah, Georgia, and yeah, we visited some old graveyards.
Ooh.
Old cemeteries. Yeah.
See the ghosts?
I did not, but we did go to Colonial Park Cemetery in Savannah, which was built in 1750, and it contains a lot of the early settlers and hundreds upon hundreds of victims of the yellow fever epidemic of 1820.
Ooh.
And it's interesting because you can take ghost walks at night.
Huh.
And the person who gives the tour lets you know that the cemetery was once much larger than it currently is today.
Huh, so why is it now smaller than it was before?
Well, they had to widen the roads for the automobiles in the early 20th century.
Aha!
And so rather than dig up the bodies, of which there were many, many bodies, they paved over the cemetery.
Man, that's fascinating, Bob. I would love to know more about the history of cemeteries in the United States.
Well, Ben, you have come to the right place, because this week on The Road to Now, we have Tanya Marsh, who is an expert in funeral law and cemetery history.
And she's in the law school at Wake Forest University, a position she has paved her own way in, which is amazing.
She sure has. You don't really hear a whole lot about that area of research.
And Tanya just blew us away. The history of the United States, so much of it is bound up in these cemeteries and in ways you don't even think about. Like, have you ever wondered why we embalm people? Tanya has the answer for you, and it's going to fascinate you. And if you're anything like me, you're going to walk away from this interview talking to people about it and not being able to stop for the next couple of days.
Definitely one of my favorite we've ever done.
Agreed. It's also kind of perfect because Halloween's coming up.
Dolph Ramser began his record label in his hometown of Concord, North Carolina, where he continues the tradition of delivering new and inspiring music to audiences worldwide. Nowhere else can you get albums from Jim Avett, David Childers, Josh White, and Sammy Walker. Visit ramserrecords.kungfustore.com. That's ramserrecords.kungfustore.com.
Tanya Marsh, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you.
Tanya, we did an episode last year, and it was with Jason Bischoff Wersel from New Haven, Connecticut. And he told me that New Haven held claim to the first ever chartered burial ground in the United States. It was the Grove Street Cemetery in New Haven. It was chartered because the local town green, the town common area, doubled as a burial site. And during yellow fever epidemic in the late 1700s, it became overcrowded. So the town actually chartered a burial site just slightly out of town. It's the first time it was ever done in the United States. You are here today because this is your field of expertise. And so where do we begin on this when we talk about cemeteries in the United States and the process of respectfully burying our dead? Where does this begin?
I think you have to start in England. And you have to start in England because we adopted most of their legal system. And then also because 17th century Protestant English practices so heavily informed and set the social norms in the beginning of the development of the United States. So if you go back to the 1600s and the 1700s, when we were sort of establishing our rules and our social norms here, you had an established church in England, right? The Church of England, obviously. It had already broken off with the Catholic Church, but it was still heavily rooted in terms of its practices and its rules with the Catholic Church. I know next week you guys are going to talk about the anniversary of the Reformation, right? So this fits in fairly nicely with that. So in the United States, when the revolution first occurred and we were first founded, we adopted the common law of England as it was at that time. And the common law is judge-made law, right? It's a series of precedents and applying legal principles, et cetera, et cetera. We didn't adopt any acts of parliament, and we didn't adopt ecclesiastical law. That is the law of the Church of England. So this caused huge problems with respect to the development of cemeteries in the United States, because in England, since about the year 800, the church had sole jurisdiction over the dead. They had both physical possession of the dead, because if you have an established church, when you die, you're buried in the churchyard, right? And so Ecclesiastical says who's eligible to be buried there, you have to be in good standing with the church, etc. And then they also had sort of ecclesiastical cognizance is the phrase that they use, because under church doctrine, especially in the 1600s and 1700s, the church's view was it was holding human remains in trust until the resurrection. So it had physical, actual, corporeal possession and also had ecclesiastical cognizance. So you have all these rules that kind of have that at the base. So then jump over the pond and we start setting up a very different kind of society that has a lot more religious diversity in it. Even if in the beginning it's just among Protestant sects, right? There's still a lot of diversity. And then, of course, you have real practical problems because people start dying before we can set up a whole system. And then, of course, because we didn't adopt ecclesiastical law, we couldn't just take the system they had there and transplant it here. It didn't work at all. So we went until about the 1850s in the United States without any meaningful cemetery law whatsoever, which meant that you had every way you can imagine people would have handled disposing of human remains in the ground, they did, right? So you've got, right, those cool above ground mausoleums in New Orleans, right, in the French Quarter. You've got Grove Street in New Haven, which is a pretty famous cemetery. Manhattan had, I think, 23 cemeteries south of Canal Street before the 1820s. By the time of the Revolution, there were 160,000 people buried in Trinity Churchyard, which is still there. On the south end of Trinity Churchyard, there's historical evidence that it used to be 30 feet lower, and they did not use fill dirt. So those are just bodies that have made it all level. So we did all kinds of stuff, right? You have little family cemeteries tucked in the back of farms. You have, you know, across the south, every little church in a little town has a churchyard attached. Municipal cemeteries, nonprofits. And then finally, in the 20th century, we started doing some for-profit cemeteries. So we just made it up as we do.
So let me just go back a second. You're talking about, in England, ecclesiastical law. What happened with the people who were not accepted into the church or who were not considered to be a part of the church? Where were they buried in England?
That is an excellent question to which I have zero answer, because they don't show up in the reported cases, right? So I'd have to do historical research that I haven't figured that out yet.
That historical research is you going around with a shovel and just digging until you find some bodies. Here they are.
They do that in London every time they put a shovel in the dirt, because they found Richard III not too long ago under a parking lot in London.
So we know that throughout history there have been varying ways and norms of dealing with the dead, right? And the practice changes over time. And, you know, some cultures it's considered, you know, absolutely horrible not to burn the dead. In some cultures, it just varies. But what you're saying here is that the process of burying the dead is something that comes out of the Catholic Church. How does that come about?
So in Roman days, the Romans disposed of the dead through cremation, and then they would inter the ashes in niches, right, in these big monuments. Like if you go on Appian Way, right, you've got these big family mausoleums with cremated remains. So there's a couple different theories about why early Christians adopted ground burial. One is that Genesis tells us that that's what the Jews did in the Old Testament. In Genesis 23, Abraham gets a cave to entomb Sarah. Genesis 47 through 49, Jacob is dying in Egypt, and he begs Joseph, bury me, I pray thee, with my fathers, right? He wants to be taken back and put in Abraham's cave. So they practice ground burial, at least according to our understanding of what the history was, right? The actual history doesn't matter as much as what early Christians thought the history was. So I think there's two reasons that you find people citing. One is because they thought that was the right way to do it, according to the Old Testament, and the other is because they wanted to distinguish themselves from the Romans.
So many times there are ideologies that are put over top of practice, but then there's the actual real reasons, you know, like with the dietary restrictions in the Old Testament laws. There are actually benefit to burying people that is tangible? Is it disease? Is there anything that's basically nuts and bolts, this is a better way to dispose of people, is burying them?
I don't think, and I haven't done an exhaustive study, but I've done a pretty good study. I don't think there's a culture on earth that just throws human remains away. And so a lot of people have said that part of what makes us human is that we do not casually dispose of that which remains after death. And so the afterlife or some idea of a life beyond is an integral idea to almost every religion in the world and has been so historically. So we have different rituals, and why we adopt those different rituals and different disposition methods, I think, is probably fairly idiosyncratic. And we've done a lot. My co-author on my cemetery law book is my former student, Danny Gibson, and he studied theology in undergrad. And so it was great working with him because he sort of understood some of those resources better than I did. And we both sort of exhaustively looked, and we can't really find why Christians adopted ground burial. It definitely wasn't because they thought it had health benefits, because, you know, the Romans put all the bodies, even ashes, outside of the towns. The Christians brought the remains back into towns and believed from the early days till now that remains need to be disposed of in consecrated ground. That's part of the whole remains are entrusted to the church until resurrection, right? That only works if they're in consecrated ground. The closer you are to the church, the more consecrated the ground is.
So we don't adopt the actual laws on the books after the revolution until we don't come up with our own until, you know, the mid-19th century. But I noticed even in places where there are massive tracts of land, like back in Mount Pleasant where I'm from, there, you know, tons of land, but still all of the cemeteries there, even the ones, you know, that go back to the early settling there, there are cemeteries and they're by churches. So we don't adopt the written law, but still there's some type of of an informal institution there that suggests you still should be buried on sacred ground.
I mean, you have incredibly strong social norms, right? So in places that were mostly colonized by the English, you see, like the Northeast, you see people faithfully following what you'd see in the English countryside. But even, you know, in places that were settled by the Germans, right? So in Pennsylvania, you still see the same practices. And that's because the English practices were essentially Catholic practice. So the Reformation didn't fundamentally change any of those ideas about being close to the church, you know, et cetera.
So you talk about the 1850s being this moment when there became kind of a regulations on how to bury the dead in the United States. How did the Civil War affect this?
The 1850s are kind of the beginning, really, because of an eminent domain case in New York City. New York City was widening streets in Lower Manhattan. And when they widened one street, Beekman Street, it's down by the entrance to the Brooklyn Bridge. It was the Brick Presbyterian Church in New York City that had been there for quite some time. They had underground vaults that had been sold to families, or at least the interment rights had been sold to families. And when they widened the street, they tore up the vaults. And so you can't stop eminent domain even for a cemetery. So the court awarded damages, $28,000 in damages. But then the question was, who gets the money? The church said they should get all the money, and then they'd have the responsibility for reburying the remains somewhere else. The family said, no, no, that's our money, and we'll make decisions about where to take the remains, right? And so the court asked Samuel Ruggles, who is, I think, the most important person in American legal history that nobody's ever heard of. Besides me, I am the sole member of the Samuel Ruggles fan club. But Ruggles was hired as a referee, and he wrote like an 80-page report on the history of burial law in England and why you couldn't transplant it to the United States. And he proposed some fundamental principles, just five fundamental principles. One being that the next of kin have this right of sepulture, the right to control human remains. And until Ruggles wrote that down, that was not a concept that existed anywhere. English law didn't have a concept that gave human remains to families. It was the church. It was all the church. And so maybe Ruggles was reflecting like evolution and social norms, but it was a clear rejection of English law and precedent. So I really think it's kind of remarkable, like historically, that this guy who was just a lawyer just made this all up and created these principles that now we don't question at all and are foundational to the whole system.
So give us a little background on Samuel Ruggles. Maybe you can increase his fan base by at least two.
You can break this story.
Yeah.
Well, I'm planning to write a book.
Oh, I love hearing that.
But so he was, actually he graduated from law school when he was 14.
Where?
Yale. And then moved to New York City. And he was a real estate developer too. He also developed Gramercy Park. So you know Gramercy Park, which is the enclosed park? So he developed that whole area around there, and he created the restrictive covenants that keep Gramercy Park private. So I think he's really the father of residential subdivision law in the United States, and the whole idea that you have like a clubhouse, right, that's just for the people in the community. I mean, until he did that with Gramercy Park, nobody had thought about that before.
That's such an American thing, right, to say, hey, let's break with tradition. And the American way is that the remains belong to the family. That's independence. That is freedom. Fascinating character. So Civil War, you have so many dead. So does that raise challenges and issues when it comes to burial?
Absolutely. So, the biggest problem with the Civil War, of course, was you not only had just casualties on a literally unprecedented scale in the United States, but the armies left the bodies where they laid. So it became an enormous practical problem for the farmers and the folks who lived in those towns. So if you, I've gone to Antietam about a couple of times in the last few years, and it is just, it's the most haunted place I've ever been, especially the Bloody Lane, because I can't get gardener's photographs of the bodies stacked up in the Bloody Lane out of my head when I look at that. But bodies sat at Gettysburg and Antietam for a year before the federal government came in and started to deal with it. And so that was the first time that the federal government ever said it had some responsibility for the disposition of the remains of soldiers who died in war during the Revolution, the War of 1812, Mexican-American War, the various conflicts with Native Americans. The federal government didn't acknowledge any responsibility for the remains. You know, the Gettysburg Address, it's a fairly famous speech for a lot of reasons, but it was a cemetery dedication speech. And it was for the establishment of the national cemetery at the battlefield. Cemeteries for the war dead were politicized, but then it also formalized a federal response, at least on the Union side. Now, none of that applied to the Confederate soldiers.
Was this a government organization where it was funded by the government, or was this a group of volunteers who saw a need and sought to kind of fulfill that need?
So I think there are a mixture of responses. So on the northern side, the development of ambulance services and sort of triage and medical attention on the battlefield was sort of linked up with identification of the dead and repatriation of the dead back to where they were from, if their families, you know, were willing to pay for it, et cetera. And so that was a mixture. As the war went on, the government's role increased. But after the war, the federal government made it their mission to identify the remains of every Union soldier that had died during the war and to place them in an individual marked grave. There was a huge volunteer component to that, but the federal government also spent what is now millions of dollars on that effort.
The federal government's capacity expands so much during the Civil War. And it's just interesting. This is one aspect that I've never even thought about before, that now you have to take responsibility for these bodies as well. What happened to the Confederate soldiers, the fallen Confederate soldiers? Who handled them?
It was mostly the women of the South in volunteer organizations. The women in Richmond did a lot of fundraising and mobilizing after the war. And so if you've ever been to Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond, there's a very large pyramid memorial to our Confederate dead. And there's a lot of Confederate memorials, et cetera, in Hollywood Cemetery. And that's because the women of Richmond organized and raised money and went up north and pulled the bodies of soldiers out of wells and mass graves. And it was too late, because some of that wasn't until the early 1870s. It was too late to have individual identifications. And so they reburied a lot of them in mass graves in the South, which is very different than what happened with the Northern soldiers. I don't think there's any mass graves of Northern soldiers. It was well known at the time, the disparity between the treatment of the Union dead and the Confederate dead.
This is then the origin of the development of these statues and monuments to honor the Confederate dead. Is this an attempt to not so much to
valorize them and turn them into heroes. Is this more just a simple pragmatic attempt to say, we don't actually know who's here, we're just going to put up a marker honoring the ones that we got?
Yeah, so I've been frustrated by the whole recent debate over the Confederate memorials, because there were obviously many that were constructed as part of Jim Crow and to be racially threatening. And those tend to be the ones of Stonewall Jackson and General Lee and Nathan Bedford Forrest. So that would be a fairly political choice, right? To build a monument to him. But I think that what has gotten lost in a lot of this conversation is that many of those memorials were built by wives and mothers to memorialize their sons that went off to war and they never saw again. And they didn't know where their remains were. And so it was a, sort of a group memorial. But I just can't, I mean, you know, the South was devastated economically, financially. So many men, white men died, right? And for them to make such a priority of raising money to put up some of those memorials, I think speaks to how important it was. And it was a real woman-led philanthropic community effort. So I don't know how important that was to anything involving cemeteries after the war on the southern side, but it was fairly politically important. And then on the northern side, it led to the creation of national cemeteries. And like you said, Ben, a real expansion of the kind of logistical power of the federal government, which up to that point hadn't really undertaken any efforts like that before.
When we look at modern burials, I think one of the distinguishing institutions that, that emerges over time is the funeral home. And this is a huge business now. And, you know, for a long time, as you said, you know, the previous, you know, pre-revolutionary idea was that the church had control over the bodies. And then by the 1850s, you have the establishment of law, but still families control them. What factors drive the rise of the funeral home and the notion of embalming someone? Where does this come from? It seems a bizarre thing to do, but what factors push this?
So before the Civil War, there were undertakers, and undertakers built coffins or caskets, and then they would transport remains to the cemetery. It was mostly in more populated urban areas, and then they were all men. And then you also had women who were, they called them layers out of the dead, which is kind of a, they could come to your home and wash and prepare remains. It was only women. So there's real gender split there. And prior to the Civil War, nobody was embalmed in the United States. In fact, it would have been considered, if you believe in literal resurrection, then you need to keep remains together in consecrated ground so that you'll just be able to stand up when the resurrection occurs. And so if you can't like cut off body parts or embalm, that desecration of the corpse could interfere with your possibility for salvation. So that's a really strong social norm, not to disturb the integrity of human remains. And so that would have discouraged both embalming and cremation. But what happened in the Civil War was you had these battlefield embalmers that would follow the armies around. It was almost exclusively on the northern side. They advertised in northern newspapers, and they also signed people up on the battlefield, right, before a battle, and offered to embalm your remains if you fell, and then transport the remains back to your family, especially since the government would kind of leave you where you laid. If it was important to you to be, you know, bury me, I pray thee, with my fathers, right? If that's important to you and you have the money, then you're going to do it. So it was mostly officers' families in the Northeast that had the means to do that, not practiced, I think, at all on the southern side. And then after the war, you have all these people who have the technology and the training to embalm people. And so they had to go create a market. And they were helped substantially by the death of Abraham Lincoln and the fact that he was embalmed and his remains were taken by train from DC to Springfield. And he was laid out at various spots along the way. He was, most reports say, he was re-embalmed 3 times with zinc oxide. And so by the time his remains got to Springfield, he looked like marble. And I've gone back and looked at these New York Times articles that talk about how great he looked, right? And like in Albany and Chicago, and yeah, how great he looked. So it was the best advertisement for embalming you ever could have asked for.
Wow. That is mind blowing. It's also, It's also incredibly mind-blowing to consider the fact that we look at places like the former Soviet Union where they embalmed Lenin, and you can still go see Vladimir Lenin today, and I saw him a couple years ago. Like, but we're like, look at them, how crazy they are. They you know, fix these guys up and we can see them forever. But then you think there is a line there between re-embalming Lincoln three times and taking him around so everyone can see him, and that line of Lenin in the mausoleum in Red Square.
Well, they still wheel out Jeremy Bentham in England.
That's right. Oh, God. See, I forgot about that.
Anglo-American tradition isn't too far off from all that.
Yeah. So does the, when you look at the gender break, I think it's very interesting that you talk about how, I mean, the Civil War changes so much. And, you know, you look at the gendered roles. I mean, you know, before the Civil War, almost no women are involved in nursing. And then there's just the necessity and the chaos of the time makes women, you know, brings them into the field. And by the end of the 19th century, women are over half of the workforce of nursing. And you pointed out in a recent blog post that people studying mortuary science and folks who run undertakers and people who run funeral homes, that this was predominantly a male occupation. But in recent years, this has become more and more female. How do you explain that?
Well, one cynical explanation is that the funeral industry is changing from an owner-occupied model to an employee model. And women are willing to accept lower wages and a role as an employee, whereas they weren't in a position to inherit a funeral home. So what happened after the Civil War, when embalming started becoming popular, was the new funeral directors, they sort of styled themselves as men of science, and they went to the state legislatures and they said, we're professionals and we want to be regulated like doctors and lawyers and other professionals. So they asked for an occupational licensing regime based around the technology of embalming. And so you had to be trained in embalming and have the facilities to perform embalming in order to practice funeral directing. So they basically just cleared the field of undertakers and the layers out of the dead. And so now you had to have this education, the training and the technology, et cetera. And so that got put into place. I think Virginia was the first state in 1894. And by the 30s, every state had that kind of regulatory regime. So we're on right now about the third generation of family-owned funeral homes. They and current funeral directors who are like in their 60s inherited the business and grew up in the funeral home. They inherited it from their father and their grandfather. And so they're living longer. It's not as clear that that economic model works. A lot of their sons went off to do other things. And so the proportion of people that are in mortuary science programs who are from funeral families has gone down as the number of women has gone up.
Mortuary science, this thing that we don't necessarily think of as associated with like medical, you know, with medicine, it nevertheless, it becomes professional in the late 19th and early 20th century in the same way that, that medical professionals do, that psychiatry does.
Yes, except you only need a 2-year associate's degree to do it.
All right.
I mean, which I think most, you know, most medical professions would say is not really on par. But they thought they were on par, definitely with the early doctors.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you read the Devil in the White City, you know, about, they're just buying body parts off people at the University of Michigan. So they, you know, just send us a body. We'll cut them up. We won't ask any questions.
Yeah.
So why don't we look ahead to future trends in burial in the United States? Eco-burial. That's a new thing, right? You can be a tree. You can literally become a tree. Can you tell us anything about this?
Well, we can't become trees.
Oh, come on, Tanya. We can become trees if we want to.
It's one of the greatest answers ever.
There's a science fiction book. It's an Orson Scott Card book about like these aliens that became trees, whatever. Okay, anyway, so we can't become trees. But the predominant method of burial since the rise of embalming has been that you're embalmed, and then you have an open casket visitation, a funeral home. You're placed in a casket. In the United States, I think about 70% of caskets are made out of metal. And then that's placed into a concrete or steel vault. So there will be no trees coming from that grave, right?
Right, right.
So the green burial kind of movement is to take those artificial layers out from between the body and the earth, right? And which it's funny that people think of that as something new, because it, all it is a return to what everybody did 100 years ago.
Right.
And so, yeah, so we have some really cool conservation and green burial grounds in the United States. So they're pairing this idea of like conservation easements and protecting a piece of land from development with people's interest in green burial, right? So instead of just buying this this slot, with you're buying into protecting this piece of land. And then you also have sections of regular cemeteries that they don't allow embalming fluid, and there's no casket, or it's a biodegradable casket, no vault, you know, all that good stuff. So it's definitely gaining interest, but it's hard to establish new cemeteries in the United States. So I think there's probably more. My personal view is that the reason the cremation rate's going up so high and so fast is that people are frustrated by the lack of options, and that if people had more access to green burial, a lot of people who currently choose cremation would switch to green burial.
So what are the environmental costs of cemeteries?
Well, the first is, you know, the American model is the perpetual dedication of a piece of real estate to a single set of human remains forever. And that's what perpetual means, right? Forever and ever. So from a land use perspective, you're taking that land out of service to the living by dedicating it to the dead. And since Christians move their dead back into cities, you can see a lot of land that could be useful to the living, which is sort of in the way. So that's a cost. Now, of course, we move cemeteries all the time. We love to move cemeteries and move them further and further out of town. Embalming fluid is mostly made out of formaldehyde. So if you're putting it inside a metal casket and then inside a concrete vault, probably it's not going to get into the water table. But they used to embalm people with arsenic and zinc oxide, like Lincoln. And they've done some archaeological studies and found arsenic in the groundwater downstream of old cemeteries. So that's something that is very concerning to a lot of people. We also, with respect to caskets made out of wood, we really love using hardwoods, non-sustainably cut down from the Amazon hardwoods. So that's not good. And then you're putting a bunch of concrete and steel into the ground. And, you know, the purpose of vaults, not only do they keep the casket from getting dirt on it, which I think is somewhat questionable, the main purpose is to keep the earth flat so you have a smooth mowing surface, because it's cheaper to maintain a cemetery, right? There's no ground settling. As the casket collapses, you've got a smooth mowing surface.
That blows my mind. How much, when you look at something close like that, you see all that. I was always like, why do they bury them in concrete? And it's like, oh, to keep the ground flat.
Yeah. Oh, they're very clear. I mean, it's very clear about that. I've got these books from the 30s about efficient cemetery management. They are very clear about why they wanted to use vaults.
So Tanya, this is the road to now question that everybody should get. What got you into this line of work? What made this area of study so interesting to you?
Well, I've always loved genealogy and I've loved history. I was an undergraduate history major and was really tempted to go get my PhD in history. So I've always been interested in all of that. And I think cemeteries are really living museums. It's weird to call them a living museum, but they're, I mean,
I think so too.
Yeah. I mean, you just experience something about community by walking around and looking at the tombstones that it's hard to get any other way. So that's always really appealed to me. And then once I started digging into the law, especially as I moved over, you know, from practice to academia, and I started reading the cases, it's like, that can't be right. That's not the rule for the rest of real estate and property. And then all the things that are blowing Ben's mind right now, they blew mine when I first read, right? And so then you just start digging. Every day you find out something new.
Well, you know, this is a kind of a Halloween episode. I mean, because in our culture, graveyards, they're scary. Like you talked about going to Antietam. My wife and I went to Gettysburg a number of years ago, and we were there at dusk, and we had to get out of there. Like we literally got the heebie-jeebies. I went to a Civil War cemetery in New Bern, North Carolina one time, and I just kind of got sick to my stomach. It just, with this weird feeling came over me. As we end this episode, can you just kind of talk about that, the cultural, I don't want to say mythical, because it's not a myth, right? There's like, this is, we are all going to die, and many of us will wind up in a cemetery, you know, and there's all these like horror films and zombies that are so popular right now in our culture. Talk about the cultural ideas of the cemetery.
So I think Western society and Americans in general, we're death denying. And that's gotten more and more significant in the last century because people aren't laid out at home. We don't have wakes in our parlor anymore. We moved it to a funeral parlor, right? So just like we've moved so many fundamental life activities sort of outside of the home and outside of our purview and control, we've professionalized and moved it outside and let an industry take care of it. And as we get more and more distant from it, then I think there is a natural human aversion to death and to dead things, right? I mean, we feel like dead things are unclean. If we're not comfortable with it at all, we just want to push it away. And so, of course, we'd invent stories, right, or myths to try and rationalize our sort of instinctive fear. But it really comes down to the fact that we just don't want to talk about any of this stuff.
Yeah, that's what's amazing is that there is the cemetery as the place you can go to be close to the ones you loved, and the cemetery as the place that terrifies you.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because it's where you're going.
Yeah. And in the 19th century, that wasn't terrifying. People, you know, Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge, Massachusetts is a gorgeous cemetery. It's a level 4 arboretum. And it's one of the foundational kind of rural cemeteries in the United States. And people used to go take a turn around after church on Sunday. They'd have picnics. You'd go visit people, right, in the grave. It was something that we were more comfortable with. People don't really do that anymore.
Thank you so much for joining us today. It was a wonderful conversation, and I think I can speak for Ben and I that we learned a lot.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now, episode number 76, The History of American Cemeteries with Tanya Marsh. The Road to Now is hosted by Bob Crawford and Dr. Benjamin Sawyer and produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scott. Our associate editor is Megan Summers. Today's music is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Eric King, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, and our newest member at the Washingtonian level, Jeff LeCain. Thank you. Also, just a reminder, if you want to get in on the shirts and other swag we're giving out to our patrons, make sure to sign up by October 30th so we can get you in on that deal. If you like what you're hearing on The Road to Now, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word. Also, each episode of The Road to Now has its own webpage, so you can find out more about this episode, get some helpful links, and learn more about our guests. You can get that at www.theroadtonow.com/episodes. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Thank you for listening. Take care.